Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 7.5 years after the U.S. invaded Iraq, the last formal combat troops are gone, ahead of their August 31st deadline. They went pretty quietly. No parades, no mission accomplished sign. Nearly 50,000 troops, now trainers, remain to be gone by the end of next year. So what's the Iraq withdrawing troops are leaving behind? Today, we'll look squarely at it. This hour on Point, as the troops come home, the Iraq they leave behind. Joining us today from Baghdad is Anthony Shadid, correspondent for the New York Times, two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Iraq War. He's author of Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. Anthony Shadid, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from Baghdad is Liz Sly, veteran Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She has spent most of the last decade covering the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Liz Sly, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Liz, you remind us in your recent reporting that, about a year ago, when U.S. troops withdrew from the cities in Iraq, Iraqis danced in the street, there was celebration. What about in this last week? Americans have heard a lot about the withdrawal of combat troops. Has there been a public response? Has there been dancing in the streets or something else from Iraqis, Liz?
Well, there has not. The reaction is in noted contrast to last year. And that's really because two things are different between this year and last year. Last year, the American troops withdrew from the cities under the terms of a security agreement signed with Iraq. And so the Iraqi government really trumpeted that as a triumph for Iraq as a sign towards sovereignty. This year, the actual withdrawal down to 50,000 is a unilateral American move in response to President Obama's election pledge to bring combat troops home. So it hasn't really received much attention, in fact, from the Iraqis. And the other thing that's different between now and last year is that last year Iraq was looking pretty stable. It was kind of better off than it had been for quite some time. Violence had subsided a lot. The government was relatively strong, relatively popular, relatively in control. This year, the situation really does feel very unstable again. We had elections in March. They failed to produce a winner. There's been no success in the negotiations for a new government. And a lot of Iraqis now are feeling very worried about what lies ahead, and especially without so many troops without so many American troops in the country to kind of keep order, if you like.
Liz, Anthony, here was U.S. Commander in Iraq Ray Odierno just this last Sunday on CBS. He was asked about whether the U.S. had won in Iraq.
I would say that we've made lots of progress here. I would say to determine whether we've won the war or not, we can see that in 3 to 5 years as we see how Iraq turns out. A strong democratic Iraq will bring stability to the Middle East, and if we see Iraq that's moving towards that 2, 3, 5 years from now, I think we can call our operations a success.
2, 3, 5 years. So now it's a long goodbye already. U.S. troops formally due to be out by the end of next year. We'll see what happens with that. But Anthony Shadid, when you look out over that kind of horizon, I mean, there's the right now Liz is talking about with this spike in attacks. Then there's the 2, 3, 5 year horizon out there. Where do you see Iraq? What do you see coming, Anthony?
Well, I think Liz is exactly right. I mean, this is a very precarious moment right here. And what struck me in the past few weeks is the degree of the divorce between the population right now and the ruling elite. It is an utter divide that's going on right there. The ruling elite is discredited. There's not a lot of trust in them. There's an incredible amount of frustration, as Liz pointed out, in their inability to create a government. Where does that disenchantment, where does that disillusionment lead to? And I think that's one of the most pressing questions, and it's not a question that U.S. officials and the military are really dealing with right now. This is a government or, let's say, an elite that has lost the trust of the people. It's not a good sign for the durability or the long-term implications for creating a stable political system. I think it's, in fact, maybe one of the most biggest dangers they're facing right now.
Anthony, who is the ruling elite of Iraq today?
Well, interestingly, it's many of the same ruling elite that we saw back in 2003, and I think this is going to be one of the American legacies of the invasion, occupation, and what's followed here. These are a group of people that the Americans helped empower, and they're still the ones that are, in a lot of ways, calling the shots. I mean, we've heard of a lot of the names already, Ayad Alawi, Ahmed Chalabi, Ibrahim Jaafari. You know, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is one of the different ones, but he's from the Dawah Party, which was one of the parties that were brought back after 2003. So we're dealing with a lot of the same faces, and we're dealing with a lot of the same penchant toward deadlock, toward stalemate that's characterized their dealings from, you know, back from 2004 and on.
Liz Sly, the group that Anthony's pointing at there from 2003 that the U.S. brought in, of course, were largely exiles. What has that meant about the way they've approached politics in Iraq, the Iraq that they now, for, you know, more or less, for better or worse, rule?
Well, you've got something of a really fundamental divide going on in Iraqi society and politics at the moment, and it's the same divide that we saw back in 2003, back in 2004 as the insurgency started, and it's been opened up again, if you like, by this latest election. And that really is a huge divide between religious parties, which were empowered very much by the U.S. invasion. The Shiite religious parties, who had been in exile because they'd been persecuted by Saddam, they came back, they formed the government, and now they're in power. What you have now is a bit of a situation where there's a little bit of a pushback against that religious style of government that came in those years by people who want to see a more secular and less overtly religious form of government. And quite frankly, there's a sectarian overtone to that as well, because there are Sunnis who don't want Shia religious parties to be in control. And so you've got this sort of fundamental divide that was never really solved in any of the earlier years, when the emphasis was basically on bringing the violence down and not on solving the fundamental political problems. And you've got that divide opening up again now, just as the troops are going home.
Anthony Shadid, what's the problem in getting a new government established? The election is 5 months and counting behind us now. What are the obstacles to some kind of compromise to get something settled here? What's the problem?
Well, I mean, I think at one level it's ambition. It's the ambition of the people who did best in the election. But I think more fundamentally it's a question of power. And it's who has that power and how is that power, or to what degree does everyone enjoy that power? There is a question right now going on whether the prime minister will have the powers he's had in the past, whether it will be moved to the cabinet. There are ideas out there of creating what they call a National Strategies Council or a National Security Council that would take some of the powers away from the prime minister. But I think we're still in the preliminary stages there. The ambassador, Christopher Hill, before he left, optimistically forecast it was weeks away, but I think pessimism was probably the better sentiment to have, and those negotiations seem to have fallen apart. I think when you talk to politicians right now, we're not all that, I mean, maybe I'm overstating it a little bit, but I don't think we're all that farther ahead than we were back in March, and I think this could last weeks and even months. And that interim is dangerous. That interim encourages, you know, rumors of crisis and confrontation, even coup d'etats. And you do wonder where this is all going to lead to.
What are the forces in contention then? I mean, Liz points to religious leanings of the parties. In Iraq, of course, there's always the Shiite and Sunni sectarian issues, not to mention Kurd. But is it strictly sort of personal competition among this elite, many of them exiles the U.S. brought in with the fall of Saddam? Or, you know, how does that link, Anthony, to the bigger sectarian and maybe even foreign interests at play in Iraq now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it goes, when you look at the elite itself, I think the idea, there are almost existential questions being asked right now. I think among a lot of religious Shiites, there is an idea of Ayad Alawi, a secular, albeit Shiite, politician. If he came to power, he would represent something of a Sunni restoration or a Ba'athist restoration here. That's a little far-fetched, but those fears absolutely exist among religious Shiite parties. Among the religious Shiite parties themselves, there's a sense that if Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki returns to power, he could take steps toward radically decreasing the influence of the Sadrists, of the Supreme Council, Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq. Those parties see almost their survival at stake in whether or not Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki returns to power. Again, I'd go back to this one point that I made earlier, though. I think that is a debate going on with the elite. Obviously, it's echoed somewhat in the streets, but I think what you're seeing in the street is a rather widespread disgust with politics as they are right now. And again, that's another factor that's probably not influencing the negotiations per se, but I think could have implications as we go forward.
Liz, you know, Americans have seen this kind of muddle along since the tremendous violence of 06 declined. You know, it may look to a lot of Americans like, well, who knows if it even matters if they have a government, or the government seems so murky. You know, what are the risks as Iraq goes forward month after month without a settled government?
Well, I think the risks are huge. We have seen a lot of muddle along since 2006, as you say, and even since 2003. One dominant feature of the muddle along that we have seen at every stage until now has been that nothing has got solved without massive American intervention and pressure. We even saw it with the last political crisis we had, which was over the election law. The Iraqis dragged their feet over the election law, couldn't agree on anything. The Americans stood back, said it was up to the Iraqis to find their own solution. But once it became clear that the election was going to be delayed from its original January date, the Americans did weigh in quite heavily. They got on the phone with the politicians. They sent some envoys. And finally, they got a deal on election law that made it go, that permitted it to go ahead. A lot of people here also feel that something similar is going on now, but this has been dragging on for 5 months. It is supposed to be up to the Iraqis to find solutions to their own problems now, but can they? Are there any Iraqi solutions to Iraqi problems, or are the Iraqis so fundamentally divided that they can't come to a conclusion, if you like, without somebody like America coming in and exerting the pressure?
Liz Sly, please stand by there in Baghdad. Anthony Shadid as well. It's great to have you both with us. We're looking at Iraq after the U.S. troop withdrawal, drawdown, that is, of combat troops anyway. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iraq after the U.S. troop drawdown, what its future looks like now, the future of Iraq. Anthony Shadid of the New York Times joins us from Baghdad. Liz Sly of the Los Angeles Times is joining us from Baghdad as well. They've both spent a lot of time there reporting for years on a very, very long slog by American troops and Iraqis. Tony Shadid, Liz Sly, stand by in Baghdad. John in Savannah, Georgia, is calling. John, you're on the air.
Well, thanks very much. The young lady who is in Baghdad is dancing around what she really wants to say, and I'll say it for her. I was on the ground, some of the first boots into Baghdad, and in one way or another, I have been in Iraq as either a soldier or a contractor up until last year.
Okay.
So I'll say what she needs to say. She's alluded to it, but she really won't come out and say
it. Let's hear it.
The minute we leave Iraq, they're going right back to the way it was before we left. We have made several large mistakes in that we have armed and trained warlords and militia leaders to levels that they never were before we got there, and they are already chomping at the bit waiting for us to leave.
So when you say they'll go right back, what do you mean, John? It'll be what the minute we leave?
It'll be anarchy as soon as we leave. It'll go right back to the Sunni-Shiite schism that it was before. The warlords and the militia leaders will come back in because it's all about power, money, and the oil.
But surely Iraqis don't want to live in that kind of hellish environment.
No, they don't, but they are not the ones in power. And it does not matter what the Iraqi people wanted. It hasn't mattered what the Iraqi people have wanted for the last 300 years. And it's not going to matter what they want when we leave.
What's your verdict on the American involvement there then, John, with all of your time there?
It's been a complete pipe dream and a fallacy. The military leadership that we have had, it's not leadership. It's really just an agenda for them to work into a CEO position when they relieve the military. So we have no real leadership over there. Once you get above field grade, the leadership falls down and they become nothing more than politicians.
John, thank you for your call. Liz Sly, let me come first to you. John says what you would really like to say is it'll be anarchy the minute U.S. troops are all out. Is that what you really think, Liz?
Well, I think it's a possibility for sure. I mean, he's clearly detected that I think that's a possibility. I don't think it's certain that there'll be anarchy, but I think there is a real risk because the political divisions are still so deep that this country will slide back to violence. But I don't think that's a certainty at all. And partly I think it depends on how much pressure the Americans are willing and able to bring to bear on the Iraqis after this drawdown. Or whether they genuinely start to disengage, whether the Iraqis perceive them as weaker and stop listening to them. It does depend on an awful lot of questions, but I don't rule it out.
Anthony Shadid, can you make it very concrete and real for us why there's not more compromise? What do you think of our caller's view that it will be anarchy? And why? Everybody knows that's not good for the nation's long-term health. What are the interests at play that might push in that direction?
Well, you know, I think the sectarian war for survival that we saw in 06 and 07, that may be over. It's hard for me to see those levels of violence return, although, as Liz pointed out, it's certainly possible. But I think this political war, this contest for power, hasn't been fought yet. And it's maybe we're seeing even the first forays in this battle. It's a battle with incredibly high stakes. It's a battle that I think the American military and the American embassy expects politicians to play by the rules. I don't think everyone necessarily is going to play by the rules. And I think there's a real unpredictability in how this battle is going to evolve. I think what you have to remember, and it's key in understanding how these politicians are thinking, is that they see their very existence on the line. If they lose this, they lose permanently. The idea of Prime Minister Nuri Maliki having to go into exile, well, perhaps far-fetched. It's a possibility if he loses out for the premiership. What would happen to Iyad Alawi and some of his followers? What would happen to the religious Shiite parties like the Sadrists and the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq? I think these players are looking at this battle, this negotiation, this contest right now as an existential one, and that's very dangerous. That makes the stakes very high. It lends itself against compromise. And as Liz pointed out, I think it's a very important point. In these episodes of brinkmanship, of deadlock, of stalemate, there has to be an arbiter. And while the Americans are trying to perhaps play a role, they're simply not as effective as they used to be.
President Obama is going to be giving a big speech next week on Iraq, so we'll hear what he has to say then. But I think the kind of message Americans are being given is that, look, this isn't perfect, and, you know, there's so much controversy about how the country got into this war and the deceptions and misinformation involved in that. But that, you know, there's a chance here that what we're going to see is, through all of this, you know, up, down, and sideways years of bloodshed and sacrifice, that we may see a relatively stable, kind of democratic, long-term ally of the United States emerge from the fog of war here. Neither of you sound very optimistic about that, I must say, Tony. What do you think of that, the prospect for that?
Well, I think there's a little bit of theater going on right now, and I think this withdrawal is probably being touted a little more than it probably deserves to be. It's been a gradual withdrawal. The numbers aren't shifting all that dramatically, and August 31st, I think, is a turning point in the minds of the administration and the military, and they're very eager to make that a turning point, to make this a one of these decisive moments in this 7-year experience here. But I think on the ground and in terms of the realities in Iraq, it is not all that different. There's often been these, you know, these meta narratives that you deal with in Iraq when one side or the other tries to kind of spin the way this story should be evolving, and it just doesn't evolve quite that way on the ground. Now we're seeing the notion that we're leaving Iraq behind a somewhat stable, somewhat democratic country. Iraqi security forces are more powerful and ready to take control over security. You know, these things are often much more ambiguous, and I think on both those points, it's very ambiguous. This is a, you know, not perhaps a failed state, but it's deeply dysfunctional. It has failed absolutely in delivering services to its people, electricity, water, sewage. The security forces are beset by attacks daily, bombings, drive-by shootings. It's a very precarious moment right now, and I think this desire by the administration and the military to make this a moment is somewhat, I don't want to say dangerous necessarily, but it doesn't reflect itself in the reality here.
Let's go to Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air. What do you think?
I think that a lot of this is like naysaying. We have been there for 7 years. Mm. It's not South Vietnam. We're not just going to get up and the last helicopter is going to leave and we're all going to watch it on TV. I think are there problems in Iraq? Politics? Absolutely. But we're not just going to walk away. The United States Army is just not going to march out of there. This is not Cambodia. These guys can make it. They can make it, and I have faith they can make it. I know they can do it. I know there's solder. I read about this. I know there's problems, but I think the naysaying is a little overblown.
When you say they can make it, you mean the Iraqis can make it. You have more faith in them.
The Iraqis as a people, Shias, Sunnis, Catholics, everybody who's there.
Stephen, let us pick it up, and I appreciate your perspective. Liz Sly, first of all, on this point of U.S. troops just marching out, I mean, it may not be at all like Saigon. The U.S. military, of course, doesn't want to repeat that in any way. But the current agreement, Liz, is that they will be out, right, by the end of next year, December 2011. That's a formal agreement between the nations.
Yes, that's right. Under current circumstances, all the U.S. troops are supposed to have gone by 2011. Now, an awful lot can happen between now and 2011. There could be failure to form the government, disintegration into some kind of war or conflict, or we might get a new government in a couple of months. There will be an agreement. Suddenly things will look back on Kiel again. and the end of 2011 might start looking like a realistic prospect. I think one point to make, really, which is what Anthony was saying, is that this is a bit of an artificial deadline. It was set more than a year ago, this August 31 deadline for the end of combat operations. And it's just kind of unfortunate, if you like, that nobody could have foreseen back then that the country would be in a state of extreme political uncertainty as that promised moment came about. So rather than being able to portray it as some kind of success or and that the troops are going home and leaving behind a stable country, the circumstances have conspired to have them going home at this moment of extreme uncertainty. But I think uncertainty and unpredictability is the order of the day right now, and it's really very hard to say where Iraq will be at the end of 2011.
Tony Shadid, you've said there's some theater going on right now in the way all this is presented. Okay, fair enough. But what about December 2011 deadline for all U.S. troops out? Is that theater or is that real? Do you think they'll really be gone? And, you know, Americans are hearing combat troops gone, but yet, you know, there's still fighter jets and attack helicopters and thousands of special forces there. Is it a real change in the profile over this next year? And do you think U.S. troops will really be gone at the end of next?
You know, I think this is, I mean, I think from the beginning this has not been the Obama administration's war, and there's an eagerness to put this war behind them. Now, what country they leave behind is another question. As the caller pointed out, maybe they do figure it out, and, you know, I think that's possible. You know, I would not want to be living in Sadr City right now, you know, with an hour and a half of electricity and 120-degree heat, frustrated and upset about the government, with violence seemingly on the rise. I mean, it is a tough situation out there. If I had to put a bet on this, are the Americans going to stay beyond 2011? I think they probably will renegotiate the agreement in some form to allow some kind of presence beyond 2011. But there is no question that the posture that we've seen, this idea of, you know, one time 175,000 troops, that's a thing of the past. And I think even in a moment of deep crisis, it would be, you know, I would be skeptical that Americans would intervene in that militarily. I guess that, you know, that's all, you know, projection, all kind of looking ahead, trying to predict, and who knows what will happen in the end. But, you know, it is clearly the changing American posture is going on. You know, do we have some kind of presence beyond that? Absolutely. Does this embassy remain to be one of the biggest in the world? It will. Will the Americans have a deep interest in what happens in Iraq? They will. It's a tough neighborhood. There are neighbors that are very interested in what goes on here, and some of those neighbors don't get along with the United States.
We'll look at that, but this U.S. presence beyond December 2011, what do you mean by that? Is there anything that's allowed under the current agreement between the two countries?
There's not, but I think part of the negotiations going on right now about the government are this idea of who might be in power that would be able to pull off a renegotiation of this agreement. You know, it's not talked about that much, but when you do talk to especially former U.S. officials and even some U.S. officials, there is a notion that this might be up for renegotiation, that that this country, you know, I guess from their perspective and even in the perspective of some Iraqi officials, isn't ready to, at least its security forces aren't ready to take sole responsibility.
Now, what if, you know, Liz points out two possibilities. One, they negotiate through and form a government. That government renegotiates the deal and maybe some U.S. troops stay on. Another, they don't. Form a government. The government falls completely apart. What happens then? Is the agreement still in effect, Tony?
It is. It's a treaty. It absolutely is still in effect. What would happen? It's all speculation, to be honest. But there's no question that, you know, the caller pointed out this, you know, that we're perhaps being negative on what the situation is right now. But I don't think you can overstate how much anxiety is out there right now. Even among the political elite, when you go and talk to them, they're frustrated. There are rumors of coup d'etats going on. There's rumors of, you know, of crisis deepening. It's not, I don't think it's only, how do I put this? There's deep uncertainty, I think, in all parts of Iraqi society right now about where this country is headed.
Could you convey to us the anecdote you've recently reported? You were talking with a leading politician there about his conversation with a top Iraqi general and the misunderstanding in their conversation that led to the general laying out quite a radical scenario. Could you share that with us?
You know, the politician was asking the general, one of the commanders in Baghdad, what the prospects for a coup in Iraq were, and the general, thinking the talk was serious, pulled out a map and he illustrated how he would carry out a coup. He would, you know, block the route that connects the main American base to the Green Zone, go to Parliament, confiscate phones, he would take over the radio and television buildings. And then he asked the politician at the end, if you become president, can you make me defense minister? The politician hurried soon after to say, no, I'm not serious about this. I was just wondering what the possibilities were. But I think that talk in itself does say that, while I think it's a remote possibility of something like that happening, people are talking about it. And, you know, and talk enough is to start rumors and to start conspiracies and to start suspicion about what everyone's intentions are.
Liz, you've been out in the streets in Baghdad talking with ordinary Iraqis about what they anticipate. What are you hearing?
Well, most Iraqis are very anxious indeed about the timing of this withdrawal. Most Iraqis will tell you, yes, we want the American troops to leave. They probably tell you they didn't want them to come in the first place. But they are saying, okay, you've got to leave, but why leave now? Why leave when we don't have a government, when we don't know what's going to happen, when the security forces perhaps aren't fully ready? Why now? Why this month? Why not wait a little longer? That seems to be their main attitude.
Why not wait a little longer? But then, of course, it's 7.5 years already. Don in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Don, you're on the air.
Thank you. I am a big fan of Professor Juan Cole, who is a Middle East expert, and I read his column, blog column, every morning, Informed Comment. And
a big critic of the war. Yeah.
Yeah, and basically, I am too. To the point that I think Bush, Cheney are war criminals for dragging us into this war. But his take is that the Shiite government is not sharing power with the Sunni population, and the so-called surge that was touted as a big success was basically nothing more than ethnic cleansing of the Sunnis. And so I see the future of Iraq with the autonomous Kurds, the Shiite government not sharing power with the Sunnis, and, that's just a recipe for disaster. And, I just think that the several trillion dollars, and that's the estimate this war is going to cost us when the smoke clears, and the loss of life on both sides was just unwarranted. And I see a very successful mission accomplished.
Don, I appreciate your call. Tony Shadid, there is a representative of that deep, deep unhappiness that this war took place in the first place in many quarters in this country. But you see Don worried that the Sunni-Shia divide is insurmountable.
Well, I think, if a government does come together eventually, it's going to be an inclusive government. It's going to try to bring as many factions as it can in. The kind of notion that was out there before these negotiations fell apart a couple of weeks ago was that prominent Sunni politicians would have certain cabinet ministries, including a Sunni politician who was barred from the election. The question then becomes how powerful is or how strong is that government if it's that inclusive? In other words, whenever a hard decision has to be taken, let's say over the oil law, for instance, or over the disputed boundaries in northern Iraq between Kurds and Arabs, what will that government do? And if it's that inclusive, if it's that beholden to consensus rule, it's going to be beset by crisis anytime it has to make a tough call. That, I think, is the danger you're looking, going ahead. It's not necessarily Sunni disenfranchisement, but rather a government too weak to make the necessary decisions.
Anthony Shadid of the New York Times and Liz Sly of the Los Angeles Times, both with us from Baghdad today. We are so happy to have you with us. And for your insights, please stand by there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Iraq and the U.S. troop drawdown today and what the future looks like for this country. President Obama will give a big speech next week on Iraq. We're talking about it today with Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times, who joins us from Baghdad, author of Night Draws Near, and Liz Sly, Middle East correspondent for The Los Angeles Times, has spent most of the last decade in Iraq and Afghanistan. Liz joins us from Baghdad as well. You can join us. What are we leaving behind in Iraq? Are we really even leaving? A couple of comments from the web. This is a serious wound in the soul and body of the United States, writes Webb. This war was never worth the life and treasure of all those who have sacrificed and given so much. And here from John, 2050, mission accomplished. 2050, our web commenter puts right there. Susan, calling from Woburn, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hello. I heard news reports that there were 1,000 al-Qaeda in Iraq and 100 al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So What does that mean about conditions on the ground?
Well, let's look at Iraq. Lislai, Al-Qaeda in Iraq now. What do we know?
Well, a big difference between Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is that Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan includes some of the figures whom U.S. officials say are responsible for waging global jihad, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in Pakistan, we know for a fact that they've been involved in trying to plot attempts in the U.S., as well as that the 9/11 attacks were plotted by people in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has not been definitively or particularly seriously linked to any international plots. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is a sort of more indigenous Iraqi movement, if you like. It does include foreign fighters, but the majority of its members are Iraqi, and they are more dedicated to overthrowing this Iraqi government. They want to establish their version of an Islamic caliphate in Iraq, but their efforts are consumed by the fight inside Iraq. So there's a big difference between Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
Tony, what about that presence today? I mean, of course, this is something that's really grown since the U.S. invasion. Assertions of a big link before disproved. But it was giving U.S. troops and others a lot of trouble a couple of years ago. Where does that stand today? And for that matter, what about the Iraqi militias who were armed by the Americans as part of the surge to attack Al-Qaeda in Iraq? Are they still an asset to stability, or are they a problem in themselves at this point?
You know, I think Al-Qaeda, it remains a presence here, though it's probably a shadow of what it represented back in 04 and 05. That said, it is resilient. It still has shown its ability to carry out attacks. We've seen a rash of attacks lately, assassinations and attempted assassinations against judges, municipal officials. We're still seeing roadside bombs going off every day. The numbers, as the military points out, are, you know, they pale before what we saw in 06 and 07, but, you know, do they pale before 04, say, or which was also kind of a precarious time, and I don't think they would be all that much different if you took the standard back a little bit further, or the baseline back a little bit further. This question of the U.S. allied militia that helped fight the insurgency is a big one, and it's a tough one also because it's not clear what the implications of its marginalization, by the Iraqi government necessarily are. It's fractured. It's fallen apart in some respects. Out in Anbar, it's beholden to disputes between different personalities. Many of its leaders in Baghdad have been arrested or killed.
Is it still well-armed, Tony?
It is still armed. It is still paid sometimes. Whether it represents a force in and of itself, I think that's hard to say. I don't think it really does anymore.
Let's go to Warrensburg, New York. And Carl. Carl, you're on the air.
Hello. I think this is pretty much just another one of those political things when they say we're pulling out. It's a magician's trick. Look at the right hand, what I'm doing with the left hand, which is what is happening, don't look at. He's using this as a political forum. In other words, he's saying one thing but doing another. We're not really out of Iraq. And all these people saying, look at Cheney and Bush, they're war criminals. Don't people remember history? Who puts us in war? The Congress has to vote, not the president. He's just a face.
Well, of course, that's not the way it's worked for a long time. And if you look at history, there was some gigantic misinformation in the case made for this war. I mean, in any case, Carl, you may not agree that we'll leave entirely, but there were 170,000-plus troops there, and now there are fewer than 50,000. I don't know if they're all going to go, but that's the agreement, and the number's definitely down, way down.
Yes, but they're just next door. They can fly over and be in there in a moment. So it's still a political trick. It's saying, look at this country and not at the other one. We still got the troops. They're still over there. They're still within reach.
Carl, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here, if I may, from Alabama, Enterprise, Alabama, and Emily. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I was just calling to make a point that I don't think a lot of people consider in talking about the specifics of all of this.
Yes.
Is that there's a lot of cynicism, but I do think a lot of people are trying to do the right thing. The decentralized nature of Iraq, the folks, living more in tribal, village-type communities, has really perpetuated the division between the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds. And that's not something we can wipe away in 10 years or, maybe even 20. It has to be something that the people want to address.
Emily, are you military? Have you served in Iraq?
I am former military. Yes, I did serve in Iraq. Yes.
And so,
I'm sorry, I was saying 03, 04 time frame.
And so you saw those sectarian divisions. Are we past that? Has the U.S. presence helped at all on that front? Or is Iraq still vulnerable to blowing up along those lines?
I would like to say we helped a lot. There's certainly been a sacrifice.
Certainly has.
Extensively.
Yes.
But I do think that, you know, we might fall somewhere in the middle. There was mention of anarchy and also mention of the pulling together of a strong democracy. And I have to say, you know, I'm a cynic to the strong democracy point of view simply because of my point that you know, people that have lived in a regional, decentralized lifestyle for so many years are not going to necessarily, with open arms, easily embrace a more centralized government form. It takes a long time. And so hopefully we'll see somewhere in between and that the people of Iraq will appreciate some of the changes that we've been able to put in place there as a part of our involvement. That's what I hope.
Emily, I appreciate your perspective very much. Tony Chedid, what about the neighbors looking in here at this? Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Turkey. What role are they playing at this point as the U.S. is not gone, who knows, but it's certainly drawing down?
Well, you get the sense that, I mean, Turkey and Iran are probably the big players right now. I think Turkey is one of those countries that maybe escapes a little bit under the radar, but it's playing a very significant role here right now. They're in touch with all the parties in the country. They've had a very intensive role with Ayat Alawi's secular, predominantly secular coalition. In some ways, they're kind of being contrast to Iran. They also opposed, or at least they have reservations, to the return of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Iran, on the other hand, has had substantial interest here since 2003 and even before, as any neighbor would. They're not necessarily opposed to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's return to power, but they're very opposed to Ayat Alawi playing a prominent role in the government. So you do see a clash right there, you know, between Turkey and Iran. And I think in some ways, Saudi Arabia, Syria, other Persian Gulf countries have kind of deferred to Turkey to handle the negotiations, or at least the role of external powers in domestic politics here. You know, Tom, if I can go back to one point, though,
yes,
that the caller before made, and I think that's, you know, it's interesting because there is, you know, one thing that, you know, as we've kind of made the point that there is a certain moment going on here, somewhat, you know, it may be somewhat theatrical.
Yes.
But it does raise the question of the legacy of what the invasion represented. And I think the caller makes the point that these, you know, the United States couldn't overcome these more primordial affiliations. And I think really when you look back at what one of the great legacies of this war might be, it's that it in fact encouraged these primordial affiliations, that this idea of Sunni, of Shiite, of Kurd, of identity revolving around the sectarian ethnic axis is one of the after effects, is one of the aftermaths of the invasion of 2003. And it's one thing that this country is going to struggle with for a generation or more.
That is a tough one. Let me get Susan in Medford, Massachusetts here. Susan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Yes, I guess you're going to have to count me among the people who would call the entire situation tragedy and disaster from the beginning. And I did want to talk about more, less about the political and more about the humanitarian side of things, because I work through my church with some of the, a small number of the 4 million refugees that are from Iraq now, and
yes,
that includes many of their middle-class educated people who have absolutely lost everything, and many of these people were pro-American, but they see their country as having been completely destroyed by us. And so, I mean, from the humanitarian point of view, you just have to look at, as some people have discussed already, the destruction of their infrastructure, the destruction of their once actually terrific healthcare system, the, you know, the deaths. Maybe we don't really know even the deaths of the American soldiers, the aftermath of the war for all of the American vets, some of whom my daughter actually works with as a psychologist. You know, it's just a catastrophe from a human point of view, from a financial point of view. I believe the United States has spent over $1 trillion. And so all these discussions about, you know, is the government going to be stable or isn't it going to be stable, seems to me to be kind of beside the point. I think that the fact is we destroyed that country. And I don't want to take away from the soldiers. I know people are reluctant to say that, who sacrificed an enormous amount and who gave a lot and who did their very best. But I think in the end we have to say this war was a fallacy. I believe one of the callers who was actually there said it was based on fallacious principles, And, you know, whether we get out now or later, we're going to be leaving behind a mess.
Susan, I appreciate your call. Let me take that to Liz Sly in Baghdad. Liz, I mean, the toll the cost to the United States has been very large. The cost to Iraqis has been very large. Saddam Hussein's gone, as is often pointed out. But when you talk with Iraqis, I don't know if they can even get enough perspective on all of this to make a bottom-line judgment. But how do Iraqis that you speak with look at the toll of this war? Its outcome still unclear. What about its toll?
Well, yes, there's no denying that this war has taken a massive humanitarian toll. The sheer quantity of death, the rate at which people were dying in 05, 06, 07, you had like 100 bodies a day stacking up in the morgue in Baghdad. That's 100 bereaved families a day. It has taken a huge toll. It's taken a huge psychological toll as well. One of the things that's kind of a bit difficult to differentiate at the moment in the minds of Iraqis who are so fearful about leaving at this moment and so fearful of the road ahead, are they merely afraid because they saw what went before and they're just afraid that it will come back, or do they feel and know that it will come back? That's something I can't quite decide. But certainly, Iraqis are feeling very afraid of the future because what went before was so terrible. And I think it really will take another, as Odierno said, 3, 5, 10 years before Iraqis would be able to look back and say whether or not the removal of Saddam Hussein was worth it and they became a stable and peaceful country and a prosperous country too. I mean, there's a lot of poverty here now. The economy's not really moving and people are having a really hard time living. It's just way too early to tell whether anybody would ever say it was worthwhile or not. And certainly right now there are a lot of people who say they wish it all hadn't happened.
After all of that investment, Debbie in Boston. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for listening. I wanted to say, you know, they've known about this timeline for a while. In the beginning, they wanted us out. Now they know about the timeline, and now it's an inopportune time. Well, you know what? I don't think the United States is just one big blank check until they decide how to get things together. Don't you think that with a timeline, most people would behave accordingly and take care of it? But this was not the case. Now they're throwing up their hands going, yet again, the United States just isn't there for us.
Debbie, I appreciate your call. Tony Shadid, respond to that if you would.
Well, I think, you know, maybe what's more telling about this deadline is just how it reflects a series of American steps that date back to 2003. You know, 2004, the occupation ended before a presidential election. The Constitution was drafted before the vote in November in 2004. You know, we've seen, as we go forward, we've seen a lot of these moments that are imposed on Iraq according to domestic American political considerations. You know, I think in the minds of some people that might be unfair, that reality here has to abide by the reality in the United States. You know, I think the counterargument would be that the United States sacrificed as much as it did, spent as much as it did. Domestic political considerations are gonna you know, filter into what happens here on the ground in Iraq. But I think it goes back to that point that I was trying to make earlier, which is this war has often been defined by competing narratives and narratives of people in power who try to dictate what the reality should be rather than what it is.
It could go on a better path. We have to hope it will. But if it goes to chaos, and you can hear the fear that Liz and you both convey to us among Iraqis that it may, even to civil war, what does that mean for the United States, Tony, strategically?
Well, you know, it's hard to say what it would mean. It's hard to see the Americans intervening in any substantial way in this country, militarily at least. You know, they had a perfect storm back in 2007 and 2008 when the violence subsided. You know, often credit is given to the surge, but you have to look at what the main Shiite militia did in laying down its arms. You have to look at how the U.S. allied militia, you know, populated by Sunnis, fought against the insurgents. It was a moment that probably wouldn't be repeated in the future. And you do wonder if the country did fall apart, however unlikely that might be in the months and years ahead, what the United States' reaction would be. I think whatever the United States' reaction would be, it's going to be an incredibly difficult, perhaps impossible, task to navigate.
Liz, do the Iraqis you speak with, do they believe that the U.S. will leave them on their own to sort out their future at some date?
For a long time, the Iraqi man on the street point of view was the Americans are never going to leave us. They came to get our oil. They're going to stay forever. I think it's only now starting to dawn on the population with this, unilateral American deadline of August 31st for the end of combat operations, that the Americans might actually go, and that is producing a reaction of somewhat a bit of surprise and bewilderment and extreme anxiety because they feel the timing isn't right. So I think Iraqis are only now adjusting to the fact that the Americans are actually going. And you say you have to distinguish, as Anthony said, between the people in power and the people not in power. When I say that Iraqis are saying that the Americans are going, you know, the timing is wrong, that, you know, they could be leaving them to all kinds of problems that will erupt, that's really the view of the sort of man on the street that really can't, feels powerless and doesn't have much influence over this political bickering. It's not because of the people on the street that these politicians can't agree. The people are disgusted with the politicians. And the people didn't really have any say either in whether the Americans came in the first place or whether they leave now or whenever they leave. So I think a lot of the frustration...
The word at near the end of something. Liz Sly and Tony Shadid in Baghdad, thanks so much for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.